Next up at 8 a.m., we have Sojourner Truth Radio, followed at 9 a.m. by Veterans Voice. Then at 10, it's Radio Zine. 10:30, Film at 11. And at 11, it's Pacific Underground. Don't forget that you can hear all of these programs after they air on KBOO.FM or on iTunes and Google Play. Want a third way to listen to all your favorite KBOO programming? Then download our mobile app today.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Soaring Spirits Gala on Saturday, October 19th from 6 to 9 p.m. at the All Saints Episcopal Church in Vancouver. The third Soaring Spirits Gala benefit concert features Heather Keller of Beauty of the Harp and the Celtic duo of Valerie K. Blessy and Jennifer Pratt Walter. The first half of the concert will focus on melodies of pre-Christian epic poetry and Jewish Kabbalah music. The second half features secular early traditional music and original music compositions by these artists. Again, that's the Soaring Spirits Gala on Saturday, October 19th from 6 to 9 p.m. at the All Saints Episcopal Church, 2206 Northwest 99th Street in Vancouver, Washington. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth exclusively on Pacifica Radio and its affiliate networks. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, we spend the hour with Akil Bashir. He joins us in studio. He founded and operates the Professional Community Intervention Training Institute, the nation's only 18-week gang intervention training and personal development academy. And that we take from his book that he has written with Christina Hogue, Peace in the Hood, working with gang members to end the violence. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. Maryland Democrat Elijah Cummings died early this morning of complications from longstanding health issues. He was 68. Cummings was a sharecropper's son who rose to become the powerful chair of the House Oversight Committee, one of three leading the impeachment inquiry of President Trump. Cummings led multiple investigations of the Trump administration. He presided over a hearing at which Trump's former attorney and fixer Michael Cohen testified in February. Cummings delivered his closing remarks as tears ran down Cohen's face.
And I mean that from the depths of my heart. When we're dancing with the angels, the question will be asked, in 2019, what do we do to make sure we kept our democracy intact?
Elijah Cummings, dead at the age of 68. 25,000 Chicago school teachers are on strike in the nation's third largest school district after months of negotiations. Mayor Lori Lightfoot said the city had made a solid contract offer to the district's 25,000 teachers.
Without question, the deal that we put on the table is the best in the Chicago Teachers Union's history. It provides a 16% pay raise for all employees. Beyond compensation, we have offered more than 80 proposed changes to the contract on issues requested by the union.
The union's demands go beyond pay and benefits. It wants more school nurses, social workers, and librarians, and it wants the district to address overcrowded classrooms. Chicago already provides housing subsidies to police officers and firefighters who are required to live in the city. Teachers also have a residency requirement. They say they need housing subsidies too, and they want the district to help students' families at risk of losing their housing. Union official Stacy Gates responded to the mayor's claim that the city had bent over backwards with its latest offer.
To say that you've bent over backwards and it's the same proposal, not even less than what's in there now, it's absolutely ridiculous.
The Chicago School District has canceled classes for the city's 300,000 school children. Vice President Mike Pence, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, and National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien have arrived in Turkey for meetings with President Recep Tayyip Erdogan on a mission to push for a ceasefire in northern Syria. Their task was made more difficult after Trump yesterday said that Kurdish fighters targeted by Turkey are a greater terrorism threat than the self-styled Islamic State group. Trump also welcomed the efforts of Russia and the Syrian government of Bashar Assad to fill the void left after he ordered the removal of nearly all U.S. troops from Syria amid the Turkish assault on the Kurds. Republicans and Democrats in the House are bitterly divided over the Trump impeachment inquiry, but they banded together on an overwhelming vote of 354-60 denouncing the U.S. troop withdrawal. Soon after the vote, Trump called in congressional leaders to discuss the situation in Syria. As House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Democratic Minority Leader Chuck Schumer sparred with Trump over the withdrawal, Trump called Pelosi a third-rate politician, according to Schumer. The two walked out. Pelosi told reporters Trump had a meltdown and blamed it on the overwhelming House Republican vote against the troop withdrawal.
I think that vote, the size of the vote, more than 2-1 of the Republicans voted to oppose what the president did, probably got to the president because he was shaken up by it. And that's why we couldn't continue in the meeting, because he was just not relating to the reality of it.
The U.S. ambassador to the European Union is expected to tell House lawmakers conducting the impeachment inquiry that he was merely repeating President Trump's words when he told another envoy there was no quid pro quo in the administration's dealings with Ukraine. Gordon Sondland is scheduled to testify today in response to a subpoena Trump had blocked what was to be his voluntary appearance last week. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has reached a tentative new Brexit deal with the European Union. Johnson must now see if he can succeed where predecessor Theresa May failed in selling the accord to the Parliament, including to his hardline allies in Northern Ireland.
I hope very much now, speaking of elected representatives, that my fellow MPs in Westminster do now come together to get Brexit done, to get this excellent deal over the line.
Johnson's Northern Irish government allies, though, quickly announced they would not back the tentative Brexit deal because of the way it handles the Irish border.
And that was our news headlines. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We have a special show today. We've got a guest in studio, Akil Bashir, who founded and operates the Professional Community Intervention Training Institute, which is the nation's only 18-week gang intervention training and personal development academy. Akil, welcome.
Good to be here, Margaret.
Thank you for joining us. Now, his piece making model, it is said from his book, has been adopted by many cities. He served as an anti-violence consultant not only in the United States, but also in Latin America, Asia, and the continent of Africa. In 2010, he was awarded the California Wellness Foundation's Peace Prize, and he lives in the greater Los Angeles area. So, a lot of experience there.
Yes, ma'am.
Before we start to discuss your book, I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit about your personal background and what inspired you to get into this work.
Before I do that, I just really want to applaud you for all the outstanding work that you do. And it goes recognized by many of us who are out there trying to make change in these communities. My background goes... Six decades back. I came out of the 60s movement.
Six.
So,
I don't believe that looking at you.
I'll take that and run. But I was part of the 60s movement, part of some of the most militant organizations at the time. And that really grounded and founded my thinking process, the rationale of why I do what I do. Community mobilization has always been at the forefront. And more importantly, self-reliance and self-determination has always been the stakehold that most of us that came out of that era implore in terms of what we do.
Was that the Black Panther Party? Or
Black Panther Party, mm-hmm. The Nation, the Black Student Movements, and I can go on and on and on. It was amazing. Back in the 60s, it wasn't a choice. It was a mandated responsibility that you had to be a part of community progression. It wasn't a game to us, and it's still not today.
Right. Well, during that era, though, I mean, the slogan of off the you-know-what, we won't repeat it, but it was named after an animal that I think has been much maligned. And that was that era. So, how did you shift from living in that world to the kind of work you do now where without much of a choice, I imagine, you do have to interact with law enforcement and sometimes work with law enforcement.
That's a very good question. It was a shift. Fortunately, we had strategic think tanks. We had elders around us. So as we progressed, we were able to grow within that process. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, most importantly, the community that you serve dictates what needs to be done. If you claim to be a community activist, if you claim to be a community leader to any degree, mm-hmm. that community, that those targeted populace that you're attempting to serve is going to dictate what you bring to the table. I think sometimes we get it mixed up. We think we come in with our expertise and we're supposed to lead the process, but true leadership comes in the form of being able to raise others to replace you and remove you. And so if you don't listen to what that community is saying, you become irrelevant. So that transformational process was based on the community needs as they transformed from that time period throughout the decades. Remember, in the 80s and 90s, that was the most prevalent decades of hardcore gang violence. So most of the people in my era, we had gangs under control. Most of the militant organizations, Black Panther Party, The Nation, et cetera, most of those members came from the founding gangs at the time, Slauson's, the Businessmen, the Gladiators, et cetera. But our whole thinking process was not permeated on self-destruction. It was permeated on more defensive posture to try to protect our community and to protect ourselves from the rampant Jim Crow laws that were still in effect at the time. So moving through that process, luckily what the process of the 60s did was establish the protocol in terms of community mobilization, community activism, etc. And so I never lost that moving forward with the process. I just had to not change the direction to change the decision to go. I just had to change the direction on where we were trying to go as we looked at what the community needed.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, and our guest in studio is Akil Bashir. He is the author, along with Christina Hogue, of Peace in the Hood, Working with Gang Members to End Violence. So we are having this discussion now, Akil, within the context of the verdict in Ferguson, mm-hmm. come down in the murder of 18-year-old black teenager Michael Brown by white police officer Darren Wilson. We see police associations, rushing to his defense, people raising money, mm-hmm. For him specifically. And Michael Brown's character maligned the protesters, expressing however they express their particular rage, mm-hmm. and grief, being maligned. Also, the context is the 12-year-old young boy, really,
right.
that was shot and killed. I mean, a few seconds, for people who have seen the video in Cleveland, Ohio, and we could sadly go on and on and on. So, this kind of atmosphere, does that make your job then as an interventionist more difficult? Or how do, what kinds of adjustments need to happen when you're operating in that kind of environment?
Well, and let me broaden the scope, Margaret. We're professional community interventionists.
Mm-hmm.
So we're gang specialists, bar
yeah.
none. But that's only one element that we have to deal with. When you look at what we're trying to do, mm-hmm. you have to holistically be able to deal with the concept of violence. hostility. Mm-hmm. That just doesn't come from gang members. And as we see in the recent weeks and months, we see that comes from a variety of sources. So a true community interventionist, what they're trying to do is go into a situation, intervene, and create normality back to the individuals and that situation, followed by the ability to create some degree of stability so that mm-hmm. community or intervention or individual won't go back to the mindset of why they were violent in the first place. When you look at what's going on, our communities, you know, we're so reactionary in terms of how we deal with certain things. And we have to start becoming more strategic in terms of how we operate. What that takes is development of protocol, standard operating procedures, and understanding of moving the process forward. We were fortunate. We were part of the movement that we never left a venue without a 5, 10, 15-point program. That's how we operated. So we left with instructions, et cetera. So many of our young adults today are not getting those instructions, and we've got to make sure we give them those instructions on making sure that their response is not emotionally dictated, but dictated on strategically being able to bring answers and solutions to the table. That's the job of elders. And we have to do that more. So in working that process, creating that better understanding with our young adults as to how to gain from this process that they're currently in, how to gain from the protests, how to make those protests an asset as opposed to a liability. We have to make sure we do that. Flipping that, and you asked me a question earlier in terms of working with, to some degree, the police department, et cetera. We embrace the concept of working in the realm of public safety. Our mm-hmm. goal is to make sure the public is safe. Our goal is to make sure the community members and everybody else we engage with. So going into the public safety specter, there are certain operating procedures that all public safety individuals operate with. We will work with anybody that is not counterproductive to our communities. We will work with you at the end of the day if you're going to create a better end result in that community as opposed to not. And if you don't, we will not work with you. It's just that simple. We go in and one of the things we're blessed with is because we're not city funded, because we're not governmental funded, we work with an organization. As a matter of fact, I'm the executive director of an organization called A Better LA, which Pete Carroll founded, which is we move forward on private funding. So we go in from the perspective of equality. So I don't mm-hmm. go in with a dictate of what you want us to do. No, this is what's going to be best for the community. We'll talk about how we can work, if we can work together, if we can move forward at the end of the day to move the process. So I won't say, going back to your question, it has constituted changing in terms of the direction, in terms of the skill sets being brought to the table. But, you know, this work is always flexible and always fluent in terms of moving and growing. It's a live field. It's a live discipline.
Yeah, and in your book, you talk about having to do the work of hopefully steering young people away from a gang lifestyle, but without passing judgment, you know, on that lifestyle. And I wanted to ask you about that. But also, part of the context, isn't it, is the reality of poverty, the reality of the lack of resources in our communities. I mean, there is, as you make clear also in your book, an interrelationship between the two. So in addition to the kind of intervention work that you're doing, peace in the hood type work that you're doing, isn't it also dependent on other things happening in terms of resources, in terms of the alleviation of poverty?
You cannot remove violence away from poverty. It's like they're sisters and brothers. Mm. You know, what upsets me, I shouldn't say that. I very rarely get upset.
Allowed. You're human.
I try to focus that in another way, my friend. Yeah. But what perturbs me is the societal removal and the consequences, not only of gangs, but of violence in general. Mm-hmm. You are dang straight in terms of when people go in a certain direction, and let's just specifically focus on the gang environment to start with.
Yeah.
When you have gang members going in a specific way, that's usually because there have been very little options for them to go in another direction. Mm-hmm. From a societal perspective, when you look at all the things that transpire in a dysfunctional community, mm-hmm. when you're talking about the lack of poverty, the lack of true education, which will mm-hmm. inspire an individual to greatness, the inability for individuals in that besieged area to have any degree of hope. And so what happens is it starts to develop a self-perpetuated hate. Not only do I hate myself, but I hate that whole environmental structure. So at the end of the day, somewhere in the process, I am going to lash out. It's human nature. When I am so traumatized, especially in so many of the besieged communities, we've got such trauma going on that the people don't realize how sick they really are. But when I have a perpetuated self-hate, what makes you think that I'm not going to destroy anything that reminds me of myself? Mm. And this is a societal consequences that comes into play that very few people recognize. When I have a dysfunctional educational system, which is not teaching me a damn thing, when I can't get a job for whatever reason, when I can't take care of myself, the basic needs that makes us whole are the ability to be self-resilient and the ability for self-survival. Mm. And in so many of the besieged communities, we don't have that. From a societal perspective, if I'm blocked from achieving those goals, guess what I'm going to do? Mm. I'm going to find an alternative means and mechanisms for my survival. It's inbred. It's subconscious. We can't change that process.
Yeah, and this is Margaret Prescott, and I'm speaking with Akil Bashir, who is the author, along with Christina Hogue, of Peace in the Hood, Working with Gang Members to End the Violence. Really a fascinating piece of work. I'm so glad that you made the case about the interrelationship with poverty and, getting involved in gangs or being criminalized.
Yes. Yes.
And also the kind of self-esteem. I mean, it is poverty, but it is also, I don't think people realize that racism, and I should say discrimination, because if you're not, if it's not racism, maybe some other form of discrimination, literally hurts. I mean, it does affect not only your view of yourself, but it has a physical impact on you, whether it's the high blood pressure or, you know, various other things that happen to people. And all of this plays a role in it. At some point, they found that lead in paint, for example, had something to do with, impulse to violence. But just wanting to raise something else, when in another life, starting out as a teacher in a poverty-stricken area in New York City, in Ocean Hill, Brownsville, Brooklyn, and there was a whole fight going on for community control of schools back then, because basically the teachers, a lot of them, there were union members, and there were white racist teachers teaching mainly Black and Latino. In New York City, it was Puerto Rican children, right? And the community was making a big fight to make a change in that. And I found that the mothers who were most active, who were down at the school defending our little Puerto Rican principal from not getting arrested because he wasn't going along with the program, and fighting for book programs and fighting for a better education for their children, they were the mothers on welfare. Because the mothers who were in working, sleep out as domestics, who were in the factories, were exhausted. I mean, I saw them maybe once a semester when they came into the, the parent-teacher conferences. But when welfare reform came in, it wasn't much to begin with. But when women were told that the most productive thing for you to do is leave your kids, leave the community, leave those kinds of community struggles and go into the factory, and then we have latchkey kids, and then we have children feeling like everything else is more important than me. And I saw that change happen. And I have to believe that it has something to do, too, with what happened then to those young people and where they turned.
in our communities, the reason why it's so easy for our younger adults, where those welfare mothers stepped up, et cetera, because they're dissatisfied with their current conditions. They're dissatisfied with the environment that they're in. So they're going to be more apt to go out and try to create some type of cosmetic force that creates some different end result. When you look at the entity of keeping a person satisfied, one of the things that the welfare system does so effectively, it keeps you on the line. It keeps you right there. It keeps you in that middle onus to where there's a level of dissatisfaction, but yet I'm basically getting some of my needs taken care of. Why do I say that? Let's flip back to the educational system. Look, first and most importantly, we always talk about education and knowledge being power. But, you know, you can have all the knowledge in the world, but it's enthusiasm that flips the switch to get a person to move forward. And if a true knowledge base is not equipping that individual to feel their worth, to feel their greatness, to feel that that education is going to get them to their end point, whatever that end point is, well, guess what? They're going to turn against that educational system. Why do we think because a young adult reaches 18 that they're considered an adult, etc.? There's manhood and there's womanhood training that has to go into every young adult. There's certain operational and behavioral standards that that child has to understand as they progress up the ladder. Let's take the case of a male, because most males are involved in the gang environment. When you talk about a young man comes in as a male. He has nothing to do with that. That's God-given. But the malehood from boyhood, what that takes is a level of discipline in terms of certain processes that that young child has to go through, hopefully taught by a man somewhere in the process. What takes a boy into manhood is knowledge, but then a disciplined use of that knowledge, being able to effectively orchestrate certain moves in life that might get them to the end point, whatever that end point that they have decided is. So it's a process. The same thing with womanhood. We can't bring these young youth, these adolescents, and think we can just throw them out there and not give them a blueprint, not give them a roadmap, and think at the end of the day we're going to have this viable product that's going to be able to be self-sufficient, move itself forward, govern, and lead. And this is what we have done. You know, unfortunately, the average woman, especially in these besieged community, so often the man is missing. They're working two or three jobs. We have some outstanding mothers that attempt to do some outstanding work. But a woman by herself cannot raise a young male child without some assistance from the male counterpart. The same thing for a male trying to raise a female child. So I think one of the things that was so prevalent in our community back in the day was that we had that interrelational relationship to where we had those others who, if you couldn't take your young boy or your young girl, take them to where they needed to go in terms of knowledge, wisdom, and understanding, there were others that could assist you in that process. Because of the way the system has progressed, I mean, these children are getting knowledge in milliseconds that took us days, weeks, and months. And I think we underscore their level of intelligence and their ability to move themselves forward. But what they don't have is that that proper guidance in terms of how to create an end product, how to create a systematic infrastructure to challenge whatever that challenge might be. That's, again, where the elders come in, and we got work to do in that process. In the book, one of the reasons I'm able to do, and my team is able to do so much of what we do in terms of working with the populace, is number one, we came from the culture. Number two, we have an understanding of the culture. Mm-hmm. We understand the mindset and the thinking process. And more importantly, the adverse individual, in this case being a gang member, knows that we understand the dynamics of what they're going through. So when we bring something to the table in terms to assist the process, there is not a cutoff to where they say, "What the hell are you talking about? You don't have no understanding of what I'm about at this point." Mm-hmm. Well, they know that's not the case.
Right. Well, what we're going to have to do now is take a short station break, and then we return. I'll continue the discussion with Kiel Bashir, who is the author, along with Christina Hogue, of Peace in the Hood, Working with Gang Members to End the Violence. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We'll be right back.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 8:28 a.m. At the top of the hour, at 9, it's Veterans Voice, followed at 10 by Radio Zine, and 10:30, it's Film at 11.
Welcome back to Sojourner Truth. And today I want to give a shout out to our listeners in Ireland. So we are now going to continue our discussion with Akil Bashir, author of Peace in the Hood, Working with Gang Members to End the Violence. It's a book along with Christina Hogue. I do want to get into some in-depth, some processes, so to speak. But I do want to go back to something that we talked about earlier. And, you know, I was a single mother for a long time. And there is very much the view now that single mothers can't do it on our own. We do have to get a lot of help. It is true. Mm-hmm. But this isn't the first time that we have had to do it. Mm-hmm. As single mothers or single fathers. I mean, during mm-hmm. the slavery days when our families were so broken yes. up and separated, we had to find the way to survive. So we find the way to survive. And certainly with some of them, you likely have found this with some of the young people that I've had contact with, not a lot of contact. I've had some mm-hmm. contact with young people who are in the life. I mean, and they say to me, like, Margaret, you know, I watch my mother struggle.
Yes.
Whether it's being cut off welfare, trying to feed the kids,
yes.
Being caught up in the crack epidemic, having to be out on the corner to pay the rent and put food on the table, and I'm going to take care of my mother.
Yes, ma'am.
And this is what I'm doing out here.
Yes, ma'am.
So that's... you've heard similar stories, likely.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So that is also part of what we are. You know, up against that kind of institutional, the racism, the sexism, you know, all of it that we're dealing with. But in the middle of that, you have people who are out there trying to get a gang truce going, trying mm-hmm. to get young people, because our children are dying.
Mm-hmm.
They're dying not only at the hands of law enforcement, as mm-hmm. we have seen, but dying every day in our communities mm-hmm. With various wars, you know, against each other. And then the issue then becomes, what could be done about that, knowing that it's not the answer, but it's part of finding a way of surviving mm-hmm. in the middle of horrors, really, and in the middle of terrible times. And I wanted you to talk a bit about that. I wanted you to talk about, in the book, I found it interesting, you talked about inside the gang life and culture. Very few people know about it. And you also say that there are even, although less so now, some basic principles that mm-hmm. people try to operate from. And then you had the seven R's that you call. And likely all of this is new for our audience. I'd like right. you to just talk a little bit about that.
Well, let me go back to my point, because I think you do bring up a very pertinent point in terms of the struggle of the single female. I salute and applaud the mothers and the ladies that have had to wage this battle independently. Mm-hmm. I was fortunate I had my father, but my mother and father did divorce in my adolescent years. And I don't care what nobody tells you and how strong you are, that separation definitely affects you. It affects you greatly. I always tell people, my father taught me how to be a man, but my mother taught me how to take a stand. And so different components came to the table. And I can relate so much to that, I'm going to take care of my mother, because I saw my mother struggle. She struggled with five kids. Mm. Now, I was fortunate that my father was still in the picture. He came, he did what he could do. We knew we had him on board, but there's nothing like that union. There's nothing like them being together. There's nothing like him being in the house. And so I saw her struggle. I saw the pain and toil it took on her. And I vowed that if I made anything of myself, my mother was going to be taken care of more out of respect and out of all the turmoil and sacrifice that she went through. And, it created a bond that could never be broken.
And Tupac sings about his mother, yes, doesn't he?
Yes, yeah. He does. Mm-hmm. And so I just wanted to clarify that the struggle is great. But sure. On the flip side of that, that's why so many of the single mothers die so early. That's why so many of the single mothers are removed from the process, because they have so much trauma and stress of having to go alone. And we've got to alter that dynamic. Getting back to your point about the actual book, I think I lost it.
Yeah, and the principles, the inside okay, the gang yes. life, the culture, yes. and the principles, if it can be such a... Because a lot of people wouldn't believe that. What are you talking about? Principles no. within gang culture.
Well, see, that's because we, human nature, we want to think that everybody operates with the logic that we operate from. Mm-hmm. And when you step into a different environment, that's why it's so imperative. I tell people all the time, if you can ever travel, travel. Get outside your comfort zone. Yeah. See how other people in other cities and other nations operate. It will definitely change your perspective, because you'll realize...
Sure.
You realize everything is not about you, Margaret.
That's so, right.
And so when you look at the gang culture, I mean, let's look at one thing. The gang culture has been extremely successful. That wasn't just arbitrary. That just didn't happen. Obviously, there were certain principles that drive that success. Whether you agree with those principles or not, there are principles. Mm-hmm. The whole concept of the seven R's, respect, retaliation, revenge, etc. When you understand these simplistic concepts, you're able to get a better thinking process about methodology. Mm-hmm. And especially if you're coming in to try to alter the thinking process, you have to understand how these people logically or illogically from your perspective are operating. You can't go into an environment and think that you're just going to step in and don't understand the norms and rules of the culture and you're going to deal something with that culture. So there's certain things that are prevalent in the gang environment, which has changed in the last 20, 30 years, just mm-hmm. like our young adults. And so many of the venues and so many of the sets, they don't listen to the caste system, the system of leadership like they did in the past. Mm. Respect is at the top of the list in any gang environment. One of the things in trying to intervene in this environment, one of the things that you have to do is you have to look for common denominators. Uh-huh. You have to look for certain things that all of the gang environment do. People always say, well, Akil, how do you go into a Latino situation, an Asian situation, a black situation? These are different communities. These are different mm-hmm. Environments. Yes, that's true. But there is a certain skeletal structure that all of these entities adhere to. Now, what's different is the skin. I always say we have the skeleton. All our skeletons are the same for the most part. Mm. But the skin is what makes it different. Some skin is white, some is black, some is tight, some is loose. So when you go into an environment, you look for, okay, what are my common denominators? These become your start points in terms of helping that community, that individual, or that gang environment. Then you have to look at, okay, what is the skin that needs to be applied? How is this different? But you have to have some start points to start the process. You have to have reference points. And that's where the structure of the gang environment comes in. So when you look at the infrastructure of the gang environment, it so much relates to the corporate structure, but just with an illogical approach that most people don't have an understanding of.
Yeah, and this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, and I'm speaking with Akil Bashir, who has worked for decades now, working with gang members to end violence. He is the author of Peace in the Hood with Akil Bashir and Christina Hoag. And the book actually has been used, the model has been adopted by many cities, and he has served as an anti-violence consultant on several continents, well, just about almost all of them, Latin America, Asia, the continent of Africa. He's an award-winning activist here working in the field of violence prevention and intervention and social justice. So, Akil, you talk about this structure, and we know that there is this relationship or interrelationship with the structure that happens behind prison walls, mm-hmm. and then what is reflected back out on the street. And I know that there've been some efforts to kind of address that some way, somehow. You're likely aware of the California prisoner right. hunger strike, the largest in the history of the United States, right. started 30,000 strong. And in covering that story, but also in doing some of my community work in relation with some of the family members, et cetera, we learned that prior to that strike, I think the year before, they had worked to put out a call for to end hostility among mm-hmm. the races. Mm-hmm. And we know that the leadership of that hunger strike came out of Pelican Bay, and mm-hmm. it was Black, it was Latino, it was Native American, it was white. And then the LA Times, among others, tried to discredit it by saying, picking out the white guy and saying, well, he used to be a white supremacist. You know, so, and these are all just a bunch of gang members mm-hmm. trying to get more power as gangs. But the call to end hostility among the races really jumped out at me. And mm-hmm. after the hunger strike, they issued a 3-point action plan, and one of them was to ask people to work in their neighborhoods mm-hmm. to end the racial hostility, the hostility among the races. I understand that that has been validated, but mm-hmm. people aren't going to work to enforce it for obvious mm-hmm. reasons. But I just wanted you to talk about that, because communities have changed. Like in South LA, mm-hmm. they used to be primarily Black. Now mm-hmm. it's really Black and Latino yes. neighborhoods.
See, and again, I applaud you, because now you're talking about answers and solutions, and that's really what we have to be focused on, Margaret. Uh-huh. That's one of the reasons why we wrote the book as a mm-hmm. template, as a guide, creating instructions that weren't there. Very familiar with the strike, was part of it the year before. In doing the work from a perspective of trying to find answers and solutions, you mm-hmm. have got to be behind the walls. You have got to be within the detention centers. See, when we have, there's a 3-pronged process for the solution of community violence, et cetera. You have got to have a preventative approach. You have got to have an intervention approach, and you have got to have an approach of stability after the fact. You want to try to get out in front. That's beforehand thinking. But if you can get out in front, you got to be able to intervene from the fence run, being able to get in and mix it up. And then at the end of the day, if you do stabilize and make change, you have to be able to create a degree of functionality and stability with those individuals, or they're going to go back to the way they were before. That's why our training center, the PCITI, is not only a training center, a practitioner-based training center, but we also deal with human development. If you do not change a dysfunctional thinking process to change the options of why that individual wants to choose that specific way, I don't care what you put on board. I don't care how you mask it. I don't care what you bring to the table. If you haven't changed that thinking process, you're only going to cover the fact of what is going to drive that individual to do what they do. And so when people are on lockdown, I think why we're able to be so effective is because there's a concentrated period in the prison system. We do what's called impact sessions. We do critical debriefing sessions. So mm-hmm. we have circles to where we try to get into the thinking process of why individuals do what they do. Look, Margaret, anytime a person uses violence, when you find violence, mm-hmm. and you know that's the core of the gang culture, there's usually a want that precedes that violence or the use of that violence.
Yeah.
So if you can find the want of the individual and try to provide options that that individual will accept. Now, you might not have all the options, and that's why multidisciplinary collaboration alliances are so important. Just like, well, I can't give that person what they want, what they'll accept, but I could go to Margaret. She has the ability to do that, and that's why we got to build these collaborations. And we're able to effectively do that behind the walls because of the lockdown mentality. You've got people that can't go anywhere. So the message or the input is concentrated on more so only because geographically you don't have the broadness of geographical area. And, you know, this is, it said it takes us to hear something 27 times to really get it and lock it in. Well, in that prison environment, you get that concentrated entity more so than if they were outside. And you don't have the on the outside, whereas I might hear a good message, but then I get back with my homies and I go off and continue to do what I'm doing. Whereas in the prison system, you know, your homies are usually in the same format. They probably getting the same message. So it's a more locked down environment. And then more importantly, when you get into the prison system and you're assisting the inmates, one of the key things you want to do is assist them, especially if they're getting out, with housing, with the ability to become socially active again. And that's remembered. See, people don't understand how important that relationship is. If I help you in that lockdown environment with just being able to do one or two things to get you prepared to leave that environment, and then once you get out in society, being able to function, you remember that. You, mm-hmm. you lock onto that. Somebody was truly there for me. Mm-hmm. This person took the time, so they're going to be more apt to listen to what you got to say. Now, when you try to get them out in an environment, you better have an infrastructure ready for them to be able to guide them through a process. So the type of work in the prison system, outside of the prison system, community intervention, this is not a brief period of sacrifice. If you're involved in this, for the most part, you are going to give us some time to be in this work. And I tell people that are going into the whole concept of social movement, community restoration, et cetera, you better be ready to sacrifice or don't step in here. Because it might be a day, it might be a month, it might be a year. I'm working with people 10 years, 15 years out that I'm still working with. And it definitely takes a toll. But that passion and drive, and that's why you truly have to be committed to that cause. This is not a game. Restoring human functionality and changing dysfunctional communities that are plagued by violence, this is not something that you play with.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And Akil Bashir, who is founded and operates a professional community intervention training institute, is our guest. It's the nation's only 18-week gang intervention training and personal development academy. And Akil, I'm glad you made that point and talking about the inside, outside, behind prison walls and leaving those prison walls. Because the other thing is to do that kind of work, and you said don't step in here, you know, don't even think about stepping up in here if you're not ready to make a sacrifice. But the other thing is you got to be for real.
Teach.
Because people know when you lying, okay? And when you sit up in there and you tell them a pack of lies because that may be what you think they need to hear or that somehow it will help them to move in the right, people see all the way through that. Mm. And it's best, I have found, to just speak the truth and tell people what it is, because then they could respect where you're coming from and they know where you're coming from. And I had actually that happen, an experience with some young gang members who met with me to discuss, you know, some things. And they says, you know, Sister Margaret, the only reason we're even talking to you is that you stood up to the police and defended our homegirls.
That's right.
I didn't know what they were talking about. And then I remembered it's the serial murders of black women in South L.A. That thing still has not resolved. That somehow they knew that. And they knew that I wasn't getting in front of the media, getting in front of the cameras, and giving a whole lot of BS.
Like so many of these so-called
telling it like
do.
It is. Mm. Right. So that has got to be an important part of your work as well, and trying to balance all that stuff out. Right.
I'm so glad you raised that point. Sister, you are so on point. Let me tell you something. First of all, why do you think people who have been lied to, who have been played for years, don't and can't see it coming? It amazes me, that thinking process. You know, I when you talk about the community, and just like you did that situation, but you didn't even know. See, people don't realize the community evaluates.
They
people
do.
People say, Akil, can you talk about yourself and validate yourself? I say, no. I say, go to the communities I serve. They'll tell you if I'm doing work or if I'm not doing work. The community watches. I don't know why we think because we're in besieged communities or dysfunctional communities in terms of a community being able to raise itself that these communities are unintelligent.
Right. People aren't stupid.
People are not stupid. Mm-hmm. We might have social conditions which creates a degree of poverty that doesn't allow that false sense of advantage. Advancement, but don't take that as stupidity. Mm-hmm. And as more individuals who are in an adverse situation, they are far better equipped than those that are not in adverse situations because they have to miss and choose how they operate in their survival. So the community are the validators. In the book, I talk about the LTO, which is one of the most important concepts in any community, the license to operate.
Yeah.
That license to operate comes from putting in work, Margaret. That license to operate comes from being validated by a community that has seen you stand up time and time again and represent it and not yourself. See, we're talking about the greater cause. When you step into an environment like this, whether it be the gang environment, whether it be trying to right the violence between the police and our communities, etc., you cannot be focused on self-grandeur.
Right.
It has to be the greater cause.
It can't
sister.
Be about you.
Thank you. It cannot be about you. And so in that process, and that keeps people sane because if at the end of the day, I know we as a group have said this is our greater cause. This is where we got to move to. Well, guess what? When I see anybody deviating from that, I know we might have a loose cannon. We might have a problem. Mm-hmm. You know, real leadership, as I said earlier, when you have a real leader on board, at the end of the day, those people that are being led by that leader, you won't even know there was a leader there because that person has been so effective in getting them people to become so self-determined that they lead the process.
Mm-hmm.
That's true leadership.
Mm-hmm.
Not some person waving a flag saying, look at me and bring the camera over here because I want to be seen.
Mm-hmm.
Don't get me talking on that.
Right. And actually, your last thought just described to me, and I haven't been to Ferguson, but I've talked with some of the young people on the ground there, and you know, these some of these folks are just for real, you know.
Yes.
They're like, they've thrown it down and they're like, you know what, we're sticking with this.
Yeah.
Because, you know, just recognizing all of what's at risk. But just finally, I mean, you're right, it would likely take another hour to go through the details in the book. But you know what? It means that folks are going to have to go out and get it.
Yes.
Okay, I have mine, and mine is actually signed.
Yes.
I have a signed copy.
Yes, you do. And well deserving.
And Peace in the Hood, Working with Gang Members to End the Violence, Akil Bashir and Christina Hogue. But I can't imagine that you have a section in here on negotiating peace.
Mm-hmm.
About the problems in the schools with the young people. And I was talking with Alex Sanchez the other day, and he was telling me
about some of
the problems now over in the Pico Union area.
Yes.
For our audience, not in Los Angeles, it's a immigrant
right.
area of immigrants with a Salvadoran and you know, Mexico, etc. And he was talking about within the schools now, you know, some of the Latino youth being in conflict, you know, with each other, and that becoming a problem. And we know, so, you know, there, and you talk about restoring neighborhoods also, but there's no way that people like you or Alex or anybody doing this kind of intervention work could even think about trying to negotiate peace, could even think about getting any respect or cooperation or anything from folks in the street if you weren't for real, and if they weren't able, you know, because they'll read you, and that's what we've just been talking about. So,
but I think that needs to be really reemphasized, Margaret, because you're right on point. They will read you, and you know, the young adults today, again, they're not stupid. The concept of it's what you do and not what you say. This is what they key in on, you know, and they will validate you. They'll tear you down. They'll build you up. But when you step into these environments, you've got to be bringing something to the table. You've got to be bringing something that is going to move those young adults into a state of progressiveness to where, again, they value themselves. They value what they're attempting to do, and they value the outcome of where they're trying to go. Back in the day, we've had a concept of if you're not ready to die for it, you don't truly believe in it. Mm-hmm. That's what you're seeing from these young adults today. And why is that, though? We've got to talk about the rationale as to why, because so many doors have been closed to them. The options have not been there. People always want to say, well, they need to take another direction in what they're doing. No, you don't need to tell them the direction they need to take. What you need to do is give them some guidance and making sure that they can achieve where they're trying to go to the best of their ability. Give them some guidance, but don't try to change their thinking process of what they're doing. When you look at every major movement, I shouldn't say every, I would say predominantly every major movement, has been what? It's been led by the youth. You didn't get the 60, 70, 80-year-old out there leading the process. It was that young adult that said, I need to step up and take charge. And that's what we should be training them to do. In terms of that community and those individuals knowing, yes, they will validate. And if you don't bring it real, they'll tear you down. Mm-hmm. Lastly, on the book, Margaret, and you covered a lot of topics. Obviously, we couldn't cover them all, but the book was written as a fundamental operational guide plan. It was written so when I'm removed from this process, and all of us got to realize I don't know nobody that is going to get out of this life alive. So when we leave here, what is the legacy that has been left for those to follow? I can truly say in all my 43 years of being on the street, that was probably the most important thing I did, which I didn't have the time or the energy to do, but it was the thing that needed to be done, because now there is a template in place for others who are attempting to do this work. We have to stop this process, especially in our community and communities of color, of getting up three steps of the ladder but not leaving nothing in place. So we go all the way back down to the bottom of the ladder, and our youth have to start from the bottom because we have not left the infrastructure and the instructions for them to move themselves forward. And we tried to change that with Peace in the Hood.
Right. So for people who are parents, grandparents, aunties, educators, working in social services, I mean, it truly is a template. Yeah. And you learn a lot, you know, going through it. I've got all kinds of underlining and
I see all your clips,
you know, going on.
You have been through that book, Margaret.
Well, I tried. Not as thoroughly as I would like, and I certainly didn't get through all of it. Like, we didn't get through all of the conversation, but we are out of time. Akil Bashir, thank you. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you for all that you do. And we are in full support of what you do.
And today's show produced by Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank the Sojourner Truth team. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. And remember to like and friend us on Facebook. Check out our website. We've got so much information on there that we are just not able to cover during the time that we are on the air. We appreciate your feedback and your comments. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 8:57 a.m. Next up, we have at 9 o'clock, we have Veterans Voice, followed at 10 a.m. by Radio Zine. Then at 10:30, it's Film at 11, and at 11, at Pacific Underground. Don't forget that you can hear all of these programs after they air on KBOO.fm or on iTunes and Google Play. Want a third way to listen to all your favorite KBOO programming? Then download our mobile app today.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring a development director. This position develops and implements a yearly fundraising plan ensures we meet our revenue goals, and develops promotional and press materials. The ideal candidate will have at least 4 years proven development experience in the nonprofit sector and strong annual report, newsletter, and grant writing skills. KBOO is an affirmative action employer. Women and people of color are encouraged to apply. To apply, email a resume and cover letter to developmenthire@kboo.org. Deadline to apply is Monday, October 21st at 5 p.m. For more information, go to kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Passport to Empowerment on Friday, October 18th from 5:30 to 9:30 p.m. at the Vitalidad Movement Arts Center in Portland.
Passport to Empowerment will raise funds to support projects in rural communities and around the world to improve access to affordable and renewable energy, safe drinking water and sanitation systems, fuel-efficient cook stoves, and more.
Again, that's Passport to Empowerment on Friday, October 18th from 5:30 to 9:30 p.m. at the Vitalidad Movement Arts Center, 116th Southeast Yamhill Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is having our annual book and record sale on November 23rd, 2019 to raise funds with support from the Willamette Week Give Guide. The sale will be located at Lagunitas Portland Community Room at 237 Northeast Broadway from 12 p.m. until 9 p.m. From classic books to coffee table books to cookbooks, treasures will be waiting for your discovery and just in time for the holidays. Enjoy community music, activities, and a live broadcast from KBOO at the event. Proceeds from the sales will support the station's operations. Right now, KBOO is accepting used books and records in good condition. Now through Friday, November 15th, listeners, members, and supporters can drop off donations during business hours at the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. After hours, appointments can be made available. For more information, please call 503-231-8032 or go online to kboo.fm.
And you're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming right up, Veterans Voice.
Do you hear the people sing, singing the song of angry men? It is the music of a people who will not be slaves again. When the beating of your heart echoes the beating of the drums, there is a life about to start when tomorrow comes. Will you join in a crusade? Who will be strong and stand with me? Beyond the barricade, is there a world you long to see?
Then join.